Do you know what the number one determiner is of how intelligence and innovation shows up in you? I mean, how intelligent, how innovative you can be, how your workforce can be, how your business as a whole can be. Do you know what the number one determiner is?
Welcome to Business Second Opinion. I want to take a minute to let you all know that I'm actually sitting here enjoying a delicious Rebel Elixir. They're dark chocolate protein, and it is awesome. Rebel is not only a sponsor of our work here on Business Second Opinion, but they also create Righteous Plant Alchemy, which means it's good for your body, your being, and Mother Earth. They go a step further to co-create a future without human trafficking. Rebel actually donates 2.5% of all net sales to Not For Sale to support regions of the world that are vulnerable to exploitation and human trafficking. Through impact sourcing, they help communities to thrive and prevent their vulnerability to trafficking in the first place. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel." We're so proud to be associated with them and help tell their story. Please enjoy their products and find out more at www.rebel.co. Business Second Opinion is the podcast that digs deep to explore questions about business and business practices. These are some questions you may not know you need to be asking, but we believe you should. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, usually, as you know by now, a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give the outcomes you really want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartow, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to these big, hard questions with a radically different take. How's it going, Carol?
It's great. I have a question for you today.
Uh-oh.
It's one that started with some listeners who sent questions, which I have to say took me on a wild ride because the questions I get, I often don't already have an answer to. They require to examine something and think about it. This particular question was, for my opinion, what I thought about a particular consulting practice that was based on spirals and colors and quadrants. And I thought about it and I thought, well, what really matters and what interested me was how would that listener learn to assess a consulting or a business practice? Like, what drives it? Not by opinion, who cares? So would you engage with me in that discovery?
Okay, let's bring it on.
All right. Do you know what the number one determiner is of how intelligent and innovation shows up in you? I mean, how intelligent, how innovative you can be, how your workforce can be, how your business as a whole can be. Do you know what the number one determiner is?
I know most people would say genetics or IQ, right, is how we measure these things. But I know that's probably not what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Maybe ability to think, I guess, because that seems actually more in our wheelhouse.
Yeah, that's close to what I'm offering. I'm going to frame it in terms of something called epistemology. Oh my goodness, that's a very big word, but it means something very simple and something we don't talk about, but it actually becomes a primary criteria for me. So it means, how does this person, like in this case, a consulting group, how do they hold how they can know stuff? How they can learn stuff, how we can consider and have acceptable sources for learning and discovery. Because most of us don't have our own research lab or we aren't in the university all the time. So how in the world can we learn when we go get help? And you're going to stand a bit in the shoes of the people who sent this question and others who might say, yeah, I'd like to know how to do that. So we see our search for knowledge when we're in an epistemological mode as just kind of a given way to discover things. It's like how we do it. And most of the time, we don't examine what we're discovering or how we're coming to do it. But if you believe knowledge and understanding is acquired by one means versus another, you are setting up preformed boxes about what is inside. And that's the only place in which your intelligence and your creativity is allowed to go to work.
I think I see where you're going, but what's an example that we could give me and the listener something to hold on to here?
Okay, that's fair. Let's create one here live. So ask yourself, what do you think regarding some subject that you're pretty sure of? You know, I believe this, pretty sure this is how it goes. Have you got an example like that?
Okay, so I guess how about treating people with respect and kindness will make them happier at work or something like that? How does that sound?
Yeah, and I think that's probably one at least a certain group of people believe. Now, how do you know that's true? How did you even source that idea? Do you know?
Wow, that's a tough question. Okay, so I guess I read a lot. I listen to podcasts, but maybe that idea in particular, I think maybe came from my grandmother. She used to say the idea of you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. So it could be either, but that seems more right as I'm thinking about it now.
All right. So my summary of what you just said is you borrowed the ideas from people you consider an expert or an acceptable source. And they are particular sources that you probably access in pursuit of knowledge on a regular basis. Do you understand or know how they got to that idea?
Not much in depth, really. I mean, with my grandmother, it was probably handed down, I suppose, through generations. But then I've probably researched it with other books, seen other people behaving in a certain kind of way. But now that I think about it, maybe I have no idea. Does it really matter, though?
Yeah. And that's a really important question, because we come to accept help and ideas, and we take for granted when people sound authoritative and confident that they're giving us a good answer. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm not going to answer your question yet. Let me ask you another question. Which is more important, questions or answers?
I'm a bit nervous to respond to this now in this moment. I don't know if I'm right about the question on sources of knowledge yet. Wait, did I just pass that test or no?
Well, it's important for you not to try and guess what I want, but to work on how it strikes you. And this, you can feel we're now in a bit of an epistemological conundrum, because people do all this all the time. Of course, this is my work. I try and disrupt people. They start trying to figure out what I think, and that's not what matters. It's learning how to see what goes on. So why is it important in your experience?
As I think about it, if I'm standing in the shoes of customers and guessing, they would say answers as a response to your question. Answers are more important because they could use them immediately. They feel more tangible.
Even if they don't know where they came from, if they don't know how to vet them, most people do it with whether they fit with an existing framework, like their own identity. Like in your case, a grandson here. Okay, my grandmother believes it. A motivation that is behind it. Or in your case, it's published by an accepted source in many cases, you tell me. Does the community you're in accept this answer?
Okay, so if it's not answers, then maybe both. Maybe questions and answers, so you can have a little context or background for the answers. Okay, wait. Okay, so now I'm thinking answers get outdated quickly, even in my own lifetime, actually, now that I think about it. But it seems crazy to say questions are more important, although that is a Socratic position to take, and we do talk a lot about Socrates. So what is the point here, Carol, and how does it relate to epistemology? Help me here a little bit.
All right. So you can feel, and I'm sorry, because I know our listeners are even going, I don't know where this is going. What is epistemology? But you're right. It does relate to epistemology. It also relates to intelligence and innovation and to the success in your life, your business, and all of the people you affect working on change and learning. Where do we come up with what we believe and then get attached to it? So your assumptions about how people would answer my questions gave away the epistemology you saw they held. You probably didn't know that. You were using pretty much what might be called experts as your source. Sometimes, you know, if you're reading Malcolm Gladwell, it's a maven, or if it's the most popular social media, it's influencers, but there's someone else you consider an expert. The funny thing to me is, I get an offer several times a week on somewhere on social media that says, for X dollars, a little bit of time, we can make you an expert. And of course, there's a lot of money in that, and there are big brand platforms possible. But it actually violates my epistemology to work with an expert version of how I learn.
Yeah, it's actually always felt dangerous to me to depend on other people when the questions are really crucially important, and to use people as the source of my answers. But, and I suppose this is where this podcast is going, why are experts so dangerous? Companies hire them all the time. I guess my question is that where we're going? Or maybe they're dangerous to the extent that we don't know or consider what sources they work from. Okay, now I'm actually curious. How do we learn to seek help in order to think through something rather than defaulting to an expert-driven epistemology, which, as we've learned in the past, may be filled with incomplete or borrowed practices? How do we actually figure this out, Carol?
Yeah, and it's a very important thing because we are so attracted to what's familiar that we miss completely our own ability to think about, judge, and vet something. Let's just try a little experiment here. Let's experiment with, and there are literally, you know, a dozen or so ways you could chop up this and divide it into epistemologies, but let's try three of them. So, listeners, right now, your job is to consider from whom you tend to seek knowledge. How do you test it or not? And how is it likely to affect you getting a foot up on innovation? And you're probably even beginning to feel here what I'm talking about. If somebody else is giving the answers, we're not got much space for innovation. And by the way, for building our own intelligence. And then while you're listening, explore how you're likely to become more intelligent, not book smart, but life smart, in a sense that you can work on harder, more complex and gnarly ideas.
And probably maybe become someone who has ideas that disrupt automatically assumed answers in the process.
Absolutely. That's really fun, as I well know. There are many gradations on this subject. And I said three, but let's focus mostly on two. So there's the expert model of how we're allowed to know things. Somebody else figured it out. They've sorted it. They're kind of a trusted source. And that's what most of our culture is based on. We're going to skip over the empirical one where you have laboratory and scientific studies. And of course, then you have the replicability crisis where we're finding over and over again, especially in social sciences and even biological sciences, they can't replicate it. And so we did a whole thing on why science is dangerous. But the alternative I really want us to add today, and it's a big one, it's learning to image life and things alive at work in an ecosystem. Imaging in our own mind, like bees in a field or a food system in an interactive dynamic process. The first one, the expert, requires nothing from us but borrowing someone else's ideas unexamined.
Yeah, that actually sounds pretty horrible when you say it that way. Maybe that's why it's so dangerous to begin with.
But you know, it's so funny. For the researching for this podcast, I went and put into Google search engine, dangers of experts. Nothing showed up. What showed up was dangers faced by experts. Why it matters is something gets more complex, it has many moving aspects and leaves the realm of the observable. Therefore, it can't be empirically studied in a lab. And it climbs up to the top and requires us to do imaging of something at work to get any useful understanding of it. And especially if you work in the world of living systems, that can't be dissected into an empirical lab experiment. But as you pointed out earlier, the experts are always outdated and they're trapped by their boxes and their biases. So Einstein, as you know, one of my favorite thinkers, and a few other great thinkers and teachers have been great examples of what it means to image something at work, this third epistemology. What Einstein did is he imaged standing in a closed elevator in space and asked the question, how would you know if you're in a gravitational field or if the elevator is even moving? Now, as far as I know, there's no lab you can study that in. There was no expert opinion. But most of us don't even pose questions like that. We don't pose, what if bees, what's the relationship of our ability to take care of their environment and which things really matter? If we can't engage in the experiment of the elevator in space, we actually can't come up with an answer. Most of us don't think of that kind of question. So what would happen if we all were begin to think about these big, big right questions? And the good news is it's not only possible, but you can help democracy learn to work and you can help planetary processes work if you can engage in this kind of experiment. Now, we don't do it because we were told by a few experts like behaviorism and so forth way back that that doesn't exist. What's in our mind doesn't count. But the really big challenges that don't submit to dissection, therefore empirical, or borrowed ideas from a few so-called experts cannot be worked on with most other methodologies or epistemologies.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me that many of our current wicked problems are like the understanding of the work of that elevator.
Yeah.
But we keep trying to understand them by dissection or isolating elements to study like we do in science. But in the end, it's always coming to the wrong answers. We call this the empirical mode. You know, now that I'm thinking about it, Carol, this conversation seems like we're getting into the realm of physics and science and isn't really about business so much. So you do know that our listeners are business folks, right?
I do. And so am I. So let's look at why this needs to be in everyone's wheelhouse, and that every country, every company, every nation on the planet, and every family needs to have people learn to do that. It's a capacity that all human beings have, but it's undeveloped. It leaves us with human systems that are low functioning, with uncritically thinking citizens, because they depend on experts or somebody else's opinion. But there is good news. I have watched brilliant intelligence and innovation in companies repeatedly as they learned how to take on a social system in their local and regional communities, working to directly help a small town, a neighborhood, a food system. And I don't mean by that donate to it, not buy well in the supply system, but picking up and beginning to image how it works. So this is really critical for a business, especially socially oriented business. No, not especially, because you have to do the same thing with customers. People tend to fall off the wagon here, and they want data that's been given by the customer and therefore empirical. They don't want to image the life of the people that they're serving and how it is you can really make it work. Secondly, a business explodes with exponential growth, with its innate capabilities developed, and work is designed for them to apply it in everything from how it is they run manufacturing to how they design software to how they work with customers. And I have told these stories, but I don't think I ever made it as clear about what the mind is that it takes to do this.
Yeah, but Carol, what does it take for workers to learn this?
Okay. I have continuous reports from around the world of people who tell me how it's changed their parenting, changed how their families function. It changed how they ran for office and changed how politics were done, and effectively including how townships were governed in a more equitable way. So my answer to what does it take is it takes applying it to the life we can touch every day. So when I first start working with people in a company, and I'm not a consultant, I'm an educator because I'm interested in building this capacity for the mind to be more successful, is that I often have them work on parenting or on having their marriages work. I have people tell me all the time they wouldn't still be married if they hadn't learned this capacity, because they begin to see their spouse or partner in a life that was something they could touch and feel. So it's like making it really practical, but it is practice that really gets you there.
Okay. That's actually fair. I have, in fact, experienced that in my relationship with my wife, for example. There have been moments where I haven't always been my best self. I know that's hard to imagine.
It is.
But still being able to work to understand how what I believe may get in the way of my relationship or my growth gives me the capacity to turn myself in a challenging family situation around much more quickly. But how do we do this as a practical way as like a business leader or a manager or owner, or me with my small business?
Yeah, so there are some clues. And the question you're asking here is, which epistemology is the person I'm about to pay or engage for help engaged in? If you ask them, they will have no idea, which is already a clue. But if you can get a certain set of clues, you can begin to catch it and interpret it very quickly. And you can watch yourself and see how easily, like you did early here, of course, I tricked you a bit, fall into an expert model. There are a few guidelines that may help sort out what an expert approach looks like from the practice of all the future Einsteins, which is what we want. And you might say, well, we don't have people doing that big a problem. We have that big a problem, that big a stuff right here on the planet. And by the way, it's another way of thinking about Einstein's admonition to us not to work to resolve the crisis with the same mind that created it. So I came up with 9 clues, but because it'd take a long time to go through all of these, we're going to do a couple of these today, and then we're going to come back in part 2, and we're going to explore all of these in depth. What do each of these clues tell us about whether people are an expert, which I call the incremental change person, where the intelligence is really only about that I can do something a little better than I used to do it, and compare it to the imaginer. I think that's not a word, but it means where people can be innovative and you can have intelligence become ubiquitous across the entire organization. So let me do one of these and see what you think about, if it helps you think about something. So remember, listeners, I ask you to be thinking about maybe someone who you think about hiring, or someone you've read, or maybe someone you were connected to a long time ago, or someone that you thought about following their path. You can tell if they are an expert-driven model, which means they want to look like experts. They want you to hire them because they're experts. They're not very interested in transferring a capability to you. If first, what they do is use generic templates that are customizable. Now, what that means is that they have created a template, a formula, a program. And they've probably written a book about it. They have certainly put it into something that many people can use and be replicable in all sorts of situations, always saying, yes, we can do customizing. We can make this fit with your exact organization. The danger there is there's no such thing as an identical organization, and things can work in a replicable way from somewhere else they created, which is unattached. For one thing, it makes you as a customer an abstraction. It doesn't mean by any stretch that you get a better answer based on experts. It just means you get something they packaged, and their marketing language and their engagement process with you is all about you learning to do whatever that generic thing is. On the other side, the imager, the Einsteinian process, which is engaging in something, is about taking a specific, distinctive organization. So your organization, its name, you, your name. And instead of having something they look and say, well, how could we kind of customize this for your organization? And they show you the whole thing, and then you kind of figure out how the pieces will work. Instead, they start from you as a one of one. You as an organization, now we'll come back and talk about how they do that so that it's not just random free-for-all, but it's based on an overarching understanding of the kind of questions you could ask. It's always essence sourced. It's always sourced from the essence of your entity, where it's going, what its own history is, what it's seeking to produce, how it can match with others in the market who have a distinctiveness. So the first clue is, as you watch someone, if they've got a theory of whatever that says, this is it, it's all here, it will all, you can make an entire world fit in this. And by the way, here's how you work on it. Here's what your organization will look like. Here's what your teams will look like. Then you know you're in the generic expert model. And you know that you may be in trouble for the ability to build intelligence and innovation, because that box is pretty small. It's their self-described box. If, on the other hand, they start with saying, we discover who you are, what you are at your core, not some marketing plan about what you want to be, but we begin with understanding you in a great deal of depth. And there are many ways they can do that, but it's rarely surveys. It's not them giving you back the answer, but it's helping you see the answer. When you have that, what you know is that they're going to be not trying to call attention to themselves as people who know all of the answers, but people who are able to give you the capability to be who you want to be. So there's a little long, but an example of the two different kinds of processes and how they show up. How does that strike you when you think about, could you use those, Zach, to look at the difference, or have you used something like that?
Yeah, I'm thinking back now to my time in healthcare when they would try to furnish me as a consultant with a bunch of, I guess, like competencies.
Yeah.
So like, if anyone is ever to become a leader, they should all function like this. And so if you're not 5 out of 5 on this scale, we're going to coach you to become 5 out of 5 on the scale. And so as a result of that, there's kind of a homogenization that happens. And no one ever really wants to do those things.
Right.
Right. Because that person doesn't actually really exist. And so there's no energy in any of it. It's a very dead kind of process versus actually working with someone from a resource kind of place and wanting to support them and help to grow them.
Yeah. And it is deadening. I mean, you just think about, as I listen to you talk about that, you don't bring your intelligence to work there because it's not needed. Somebody else has done the thinking. And I bet you all that was justified by some, quote, expert opinion, maybe based on research. So this is neurologically based. Be very skeptical. One other just really quick way you can tell, and we'll cover this one in more depth and all 9 of these on part 2, is that they nearly always are based on training. Of course, if it's generic, that's pretty easy to do. Here's the template, here's the flow, here's the steps, here's what you do this year or this month, and over some period of time, you're able to lay it out. and you can have a train the trainers, because the answer is already given, right? And people want the answers, and it's easy to sell a train the trainers. Secondly, though, and that's the expert model. If you go to our Einstein model, where people are imaging something at work, imaging an organization at work, imaging the customers, consumers, co-creators, all the way back to the supply system, image them at work and come to understand them, then what you will be doing is developing capability for them to invent their own understanding. And we've talked here before about you'd be making sure that they felt in their own locus of control, not in ours, not in our system, because in the train the trainers, you get blue belts, black belts, you get to a certain level of color of your organization, and then you've achieved the ideal. So this is, I think, the first step to us understanding that if you want, you listeners, several of you asked me to evaluate these particular consultants, this is how I would go about doing it. So I'd be interested to, again, see if this strikes Zach, and then to hear from others about what difference it would make to see these two epistemologies at work.
Yeah, you know, I'm reflecting as you're talking. I'm considering the correlation between intelligence and innovation. My first thought is that we have some pretty outdated ideas about how intelligence works. That's pretty clear to me. The first kind of primary idea about intelligence, and the more commonly used one, is more of a fixed idea and doesn't have room for people to grow, right? The measurable kind of IQ-based version. Whereas the second you offered gives a more clear path towards people growing and learning to develop over time, to become increasingly more intelligent through many different ways. That's how I'm struck in the moment anyways.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. And I personally think, I'd be interested to your opinion, that it's a lot more fun to think about how we could evaluate someone rather than fall into the evaluation, because it's not about our opinion, it's about our ability to think about it. So I really enjoyed this. And I'm hoping that a few consultants will send us more of their wares, more of their stories, and help us think about how they're thinking about what they bring. Can they see themselves in an expert model? Does this affect them?
Totally. And so next podcast, we're going to dig into the other seven of these to kind of look more deeply at the contrast between expert and imaginers.
Right. We are. And one other thing that I would love to point out is we're getting an increasing number of listeners. Please tell everybody to come join us. But we had Gary from Vermont who sent in some questions we're going to be covering in the very short run, which is like, what is Agile? How do we think about that? How do we assess it? And how does Scrum fit into this? And I think he mentioned something like radical candor. We really love having you give us the ideas that we don't know the answer to either, but we know how to think about it. So hopefully you'll just keep sending us your ideas and ask us questions that we have to figure out. By the way, we're now on Spotify, and a few other new places are rolling out this week.
So just to follow on to that, don't forget to email us about your organization and business practices. The email, as always, is carol@businesssecondopinion.com. What worldview do you see yourself continuing to fall into? What aspirations do you have to think and work differently? As always, leave us a question, as Carol said, to speak about on an upcoming podcast. We love that stuff. And let us know what you think of our show and its focus and content. And as always, we also want to acknowledge UDT as one of our sponsors. They are definitely one of the courageous ones that continues to question and examine themselves and their ways of working. Carol, what do you think about NUMMI?
Yeah, I think they're great. And I agree, people should pay attention. And NUMMI loves questions too. If you've got questions for them, send them along.
This has been Business Second Opinion.